This is Louise Sproul, and I'm here today with Sheila Hebert. And Sheila is here to talk today about her new book called Stonefield Stories. Welcome, Sheila.
Thank you, Louise.
It's such a pleasant read, your book, and I have to say that I had the privilege of working on it with you, and I felt it would be really wonderful to talk about where the idea for the book came from and how long these memories have been living in your mind. And maybe you can just tell us a little bit in general what the book is about for our listeners.
Certainly. My parents, during the Second World War, thought it might be a good idea to move out of the city, at least for part of the time, in case things worsened in Canada.
Oh.
So their idea was to buy a place in the country that they could use to for shelter, obviously, but also to grow food and to be safe. They found the perfect place in a little hamlet, actually, called Stonefield, which is on the Ottawa River, just below Grenville. We spent many, many summers there. The war finished. We just kept going and enjoyed living in that community very, very much. And we just never thought anything would change. But life changes. And it was necessary for the government to build a dam in the Ottawa River in the late 50s to increase the supply of electricity to Montreal. And that meant that it had a serious impact on our little place called Stonefield.
Right. And so I'm hearing you say that during World War II that your parents were looking for sort of a safe escape, maybe somewhere in case, I guess they imagined the city being bombed. So this must have been quite a change for you from being in the city to coming out to this little hamlet, as you say, Stonefield.
Yes, because my mother was certainly, she was born in the city, of Montreal in Maisonneuve, actually, and lived there all her adult life and till she married. And my father lived in Lachine, which was sort of semi-rural at the time when his family came from Ireland in 1913. And my mother's experience of the country actually came through her association with the CGIT, which was Canadian Girls in Training.
I remember my mother being in
that's right.
CGIT.
And she always talked about how wonderful it was that she got to go to camp with the CGIT in Plaisance, which is just farther up the Ottawa River from where Stonefield was. And she loved it and always was interested
in
country living, yes.
So that's maybe what led them to look in this area.
Yeah, I really think that's probably what triggered it, because my father had no association with that area. Turned out to be a wonderful thing.
Yes. Well, certainly in your book, there's the kind of mixed feelings in the book, I guess, certainly that I felt. There's sort of that joy and abandon from another time, and I guess abandon is maybe a wild-sounding word, but we had talked about this, that there's a certain quality of freedom in that book.
Oh, yes.
That I know that the people sort of our age really pick up on. And I wonder if you could talk a bit more about that, about your freedom during those times.
Yes, well, it was certainly a very different time. And when my parents bought the property, they bought it furnished. Everything was in the house. There were no toys in the house of any kind. There was no bicycle in the shed. There was nothing like that. There was no wagon. And there never was, and we never needed anything. That's the fascinating part. There was a gramophone in the living room, a wind-up gramophone, and when we were old enough, we certainly hauled out all the records. They were records from the 20s and 30s and played them and were perfectly happy with that. There were magazines and books that were very ancient, really, but on rainy days, we were quite content with that. But essentially, our days were filled with activities outside the house and always the interaction with neighbors. And I think what a wonderful routine it was, because after breakfast, we had a few chores to do, which we complained about bitterly, but it involved going to the pump to get drinking water, going to the canal to get a couple of buckets of water for washing and so on. And we stretched these out, of course. And I don't remember my mother ever complaining about it, but going to get water at the pump meant you stop to pat every dog on the way and talk to anybody yeah. that might be there and pick flowers or whatever.
Yeah.
So that always took up time. Then we had time to play. There were always trees to climb, creeks to play in. Then we went swimming because the canal was right in front of the house.
Yes.
And then it was lunchtime. Then it was another out the door you go. Then it was another time to swim. Then it was supper time. And then it was time to visit with the neighbors. It was a wonderful routine. Very healthy when I think
yes,
about it.
Yes, you know? Yes. Yeah. And I think maybe it's time we should just mention maybe for people that might not understand exactly where Stonefield is. I mean, how long would it have taken you to get there from Lachine?
It's well, in the beginning, we followed, I wouldn't even remember what road it was, but it was a very small, not even a highway,
yes.
followed the river all the way from Montreal and
yeah,
across
the Yeah, it Hawkesbury. Was the old highway, that's
yes,
right.
Yeah, so, and, you know, I would imagine it was a couple of hours. And in the beginning, my dad didn't have a car of his own, and we actually came up by train.
Oh.
So it would involve taking a taxi from our house in Verdun, where we were living when I was small, to Windsor Station, and then getting on the train, complete with dog, and a huge steamer trunk, because everything
oh,
had to
for
be
the whole summer.
For the whole summer, all their clothing and so on. And it was always a source of amusement that our dog hated, of course, being relegated to the baggage car. And my father yeah. always ended up having to go into the baggage car and sit with him because he howled
oh.
so much. So we would take the train and...
And where did you get off the train
there
here?
There was actually a station in Stonefield.
Oh, my.
But it involved my mother making arrangements from Montreal for a taxi to pick us up at the train
oh.
and transport us to the house. I mean, it was a wonderful adventure. We loved it. The train
yes.
was wonderful. And that was more than an hour, probably
right.
2 or 3 hours from beginning to end.
And for local people listening, I think like I'm sort of oohing and aahing because I can sort of imagine the community was there having grown up around here, but probably it's about maybe a little more than halfway between Hawkesbury and the
That's
town
right.
of Carillon.
Yeah.
And, you know, we've all, a lot of locals have probably taken the drive there, and it's kind
yeah.
of sparsely populated now, but it's just, it's quite something to realize that there was a whole
yeah.
village. Like, I've heard of Stonefield, and I hadn't realized that it was such a community until I read through
yes.
your book, and I thought,
yeah.
boy, it really...
Yeah, a little bit mighty.
Yes, a little bit mighty. And so So your summer's there. So what was? How old were you the last time that you were there?
I was 17 when we were expropriated, and I'd started going there when I was 2 years old. So I was very, very fortunate to have all those years there.
Right. Yeah. And what happened at the time of the expropriation? Like, was everybody sad? Were people wanting to fight it? Or what was happening in the neighborhood? Like, what...
Well, you know, there was a lot of talk which went over my head, quite frankly, when I was in my teens about the dam. People knew about it, and I think there were very mixed feelings. You know, the more optimistic people sort of think, well, adventure, maybe here's a chance to,
yeah.
you know, to make a move or do something different. But for most people, it was very distressing. It really was very distressing.
Yeah.
Well, it was the unknown, and to lose your home.
And yes.
It's about the worst thing I think you can imagine. It's the place where you feel safest, where your connections are strongest, and it's so familiar. So
yeah.
There was a lot of anxiety and anguish about it. I don't remember if there was organized resistance.
Right.
I don't remember that at all. But maybe there was. I don't know.
And did the expropriation happen? Sort of, did you get notified one summer and it was going to happen the very next year or the next 2 years down the road? Or was it just very kind of sudden, or do you remember?
No, I think it was months.
Wow.
It seems to me it was, you know, with...
Like it wasn't something you were waiting for years ahead.
No, no,
it
no,
happened quite.
No, there was, as I say, there were years where there was a lot of talk, and then it was obvious that the construction began, and you know, we would hear from the people that were actually working on the construction, you know, what the progress was.
Oh,
and so we knew. So when the time came, I was it was the summer. I was 16, that at the end of the summer is when the notifications came, the visiting came, and then the official paperwork came. I remember that it came in the winter to the house at home in the city for us, you know. And then there was we left the following summer, but other people had almost a year or so after that to actually move away.
And you were saying, like, how did your parents react? And did you move all of your furniture out, or did they? Was it just strange?
My parents were quite philosophical about it. My father was fascinated with the dam, the construction of it, and what the implications were. And they thought that it probably was a good time because, as I say, I was 16 or 17, and my sister and the other children, that my aunt's children that were with us, they were all older than I was, and they had already started moving on, either going away to study or to work. And they weren't coming to the country in the same way for the summer.
So it was sort of the end of
a part of their lives. And so they thought, well, it probably won't make a lot of difference, that it was a natural ending. I was very distressed, and I wasn't at the stage of...
You weren't ready to let go of that.
To let go of it at all. I was very, very unhappy about it. And I was quite puzzled because my parents took very little furniture out of the house. My sister was getting married a couple of years after that, so they took a few pieces for her, and they literally just walked out and left everything else. There wasn't room to bring it all home.
No.
And and I managed to plead for a couple of pieces. One of which I still have.
Is that right?
And some small things, just small things, you know.
Yeah.
But they just left it. And I remember going back to visit with neighbors who were still living there and seeing a man dismantling the front porch for the wood. Because when the buildings were empty, the government allowed people to go and
salvage
what they wanted. And he was working away, and I remember going to the gate and standing and watching him and being so devastated to see that, you know.
Yeah. So time marched on,
yes.
And you went on to become a teacher.
That's right.
A school teacher.
That's right. And children being children, they always like to know something about their teacher.
Yes.
And they would ask me year after year, every once in a while there'd be one child that would say, what was life like when you were young, you know?
Yes.
And instead of just describing things, I found myself right immediately talking about Stonefield. I never mentioned the fact that I actually grew up in the city.
Yeah.
I only ever talked about the time in the country, and I thought, that's kind of funny, isn't it funny? But they loved those stories, and what they loved was the fact that we went out to play, and adults didn't seem to know where we were or be worried about it, that we weren't warned against neighbors or strangers.
We talked about this before, and I grew up in the country around here, and you could hardly wait to get out of the house and easily be gone 4 or 5 all afternoon.
Yeah.
You're gone.
Yeah.
And then you'd show up for supper, and
that's
nobody
right.
said a word.
No. My mother actually at one point bought herself a whistle to get us back for meals because we'd go off. And there was no point calling because we were out of range.
In fact, that's one of the things that I always said to myself I remembered about my childhood was that adventure.
Yes.
And so my daughter, we lived in Van Cliquil, and it was almost like a dinner bell outside the door. And I said, if I need you or it's time to come home, I will ring the bell.
Yeah.
And if you're in the neighborhood, you'll hear it.
Yeah. Well, that's what my mother did. And, you know, we lived, as I said, on the canal. So the echo was tremendous.
Oh, of course.
You know, it didn't matter how far we were, we would hear it.
I can't imagine living that close to the canal. Like, the landscape is so different now.
Yes.
It must have been...
It was beautiful. It was beautiful. And, you know, now, once I was a mother myself, I began to think, would I have been as comfortable as my mother was with us just roaming around like that? But she taught us all to swim. And we were always brought up to think... and to understand, you don't go in the water unless there's an adult. And, you know, we never did. which is amazing considering how children are, really.
Yes.
But we didn't. But, I mean, she took us swimming every single day, two or three times a day, sometimes at night, even if it was hot. So it wasn't that we were deprived of being in the water. So I guess that's why we respected that rule. But she never did seem to worry about us falling in the water. I think I would have been a helicopter parent. A young child, you know.
And so there you are over the years telling these stories to your students.
Yeah.
And then when did you sort of get the idea that you wanted to write them down? Is it something people were telling you to do, or was it just inside you that maybe the time was now to write these down?
Well, it started actually, the idea of writing them down started with one student, a girl who was very interested in these stories. And of all the students, she would be the one to seek me out later in the day and ask more questions. She always wanted to know more. And then one day in the classroom, when I told a story, I don't remember what it was, she said, couldn't we have a field trip and go and visit?
Wow.
And I said, well, it's not there anymore. And she said, what? How can it not be there anymore? And so I started to explain about the dam and expropriation and the flooding, and she cried, and so did other children. They cried,
and they
were just full of questions. And so she said, "You have to write how it ended."
Wow!
And she said, "I'd like it tomorrow." So that night, I went home, and it was about 11 o'clock by the time I got around to, I have to do this for her, and I wrote it in about half an hour. And I wrote the ending. I called it Heaven.
Oh, my goodness.
And they were waiting the next day. It wasn't story time as a fill-in. They wanted it as soon as the class started in the morning. So I thought, maybe I should start writing some of these things down. So when I retired, which was just at the end of that year, I thought, well, this would be a nice little project for me. And I just wrote when I thought about things.
Yes.
And they were not very good when I started. I felt they were not good. It took me a long time to figure out how to write them so that I could convey a real atmosphere of the place and what the people were like. So I did this for about 10 years, over and over again, working at them. I took a little course and read a lot of books and tried to develop a much better technique, you know, so that I could get my message the way I wanted it to be. And I enjoyed it. The more I worked at it, the more I liked it.
Yes. Well, it really does have an ambiance or an atmosphere, and it really, it's a kudos to you for learning a technique or seeing that something needed to be, because they sound like they just rolled out of you effortlessly.
Thank you,
really.
Thank you.
They're just anybody listening. Her books are now at the Review for sale, but they're just a wonderful story of a community in a time. You know, I remember when we were trying to figure out how to describe it. It was just kind of a time that sort of hangs in the air. It's like these summers that are just sort of suspended. And that brings me to, I wanted to ask you, you know, you've kept these memories for a long time and these stories, and I know that you mentioned in the book you and your husband used to go and picnic there.
Yes,
you know,
we still do.
Good for you.
Yes.
Do you think the stories that you're telling, something I was going to say, you have so many conversations, are those, you know, conversations you remember, or have you patched pieces of little things that you've heard, or do you really remember things that clearly? Because, you know, research today says every time you remember something, it changes a bit.
Oh, yes.
So I guess I'm asking, is it partly fictionalized, or is it mostly your memories, what you remember?
It's partly fictionalized, that's for sure. There are things in there that are exactly the way that I remember them. But based on what you say, can I say that are exactly the way it happened? I don't know, because I was very young when I, some of these things that I...
But they, those people seem real. Yeah, I can imagine your kids people, saying, what happens next?
Yes.
Or what's that? You know, the people seem real. They seem like people that I would have known. You know, they just seem like real people.
Yeah.
And their behavior and their characteristics are consistent. You know, to me, that's the talent... your talent showing in the stories that people are real. You know, there's nothing worse than reading a book when the character seems like very, you know, they don't lift off the page and they just, you think, oh, that's not consistent with, or you can't get to know them.
Yes.
But these people, you get to know them, you know.
Well, you know, I think of the four of us children who spent our summers there, as I said before, I was the youngest one. And, I trailed around after my mother everywhere she went. She used to call me the shadow, actually.
Oh.
I think she would have liked to escape. But I learned very quickly that if I were very quiet, I had a very good chance of being allowed to accompany her anywhere, you know. And so I learned to be quiet and listen. And I took a lot in that I obviously didn't all understand at the time. But it stayed in my head.
Yes.
And I came to have, obviously, a greater understanding as time went by. So it wasn't hard for me to write the conversations.
I know, because there's a lot of visits that are paid and the things that are being said. It's like you're invisible, but yet you're there.
Yeah.
So that's, I know there are kids who are watchers and listeners. And the quieter you are, the more you get in on, right?
That's
the
right. That's right.
The more you learn about what's really going on.
Yeah. They forget you're there.
They do.
You know? And so, you know, and if you, the child being quiet like that, I think they just, they didn't tailor their conversation or leave anything out because I was there. They were
They
unaware.
Forgot you were
they
there.
Forgot
That's
I was
right.
There. And you know, these people were like extended family to me. I have so much respect for them because I learned so much about life from them.
Yes.
And I learned how to live from them. And above all, I learned the importance of community. It's hard to find.
It is. It is hard to find. We're both choking up here thinking about it. But that is, you were living in the city, but you experienced, you lived and grew up in life in a small community, which is...
Yeah, it was a privilege.
You can't put a price on that,
A great privilege,
So how do your children feel about this book? How many children do you have?
I have two daughters, and they're bedtime stories. Often were Stonefield stories, and they got to know the people, you know, talk about them as if they had been there too, you know.
Yes.
And the few people that we were able to stay in contact with over the years were close friends, so they got to know them too. And of course, when we get together with these people, we always talk about Stonefield. So they, too, learned if they were quiet, they learned a lot.
Yes. Yes. And how have you been in touch with any of the people that you from Stonefield? And are they excited about the book or what's happening with?
Yes. Well, actually, I was very, very fortunate to have a lot of contact with a fellow named Leonard Dupuy, whose family were our neighbors in Stonefield. And we kept in touch over the years, and he was a storyteller par excellence.
He was.
Really a wonderful storyteller. And his family had a great knowledge of the community and the people. So we talked a lot. And when I was writing, if I wasn't sure about something or wanted to know more, I just had to call him. And
isn't that
in
something?
In no time... I had another story almost from him.
Isn't
you know, that,
that
was wonderful. And Sylvia Robert, whose family actually lived in Greases Point, she and her sister and brother, we've all stayed in touch over the years.
Oh.
And so they're, you know, Sylvia's very interested in it. I just actually got a book to her yesterday. Leonard unfortunately died before the book was published, so that's a real sadness for me. But my daughters are very interested, and one of my daughters, Valerie, she lives in Ontario in Newmarket. She wrote to me and said she's reading it very slowly.
Oh, she's savoring it.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of reading it, maybe now's a good time to ask you to read a little excerpt.
I would be happy to.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll just read you the beginning, I guess, of a story that I call Missing Shingles.
I love this one.
In the summer of 1951, our roof was leaking so badly that we used our biggest soup pot to catch the drips at the top of the stairs, the tin washtub to handle the deluge in the hall, and our spare chamber pot for the overflow in the back bedroom. After a particularly rainy spell, Dad said, "It's gone too far gone to patch. I'll have to reshingle the whole thing, and the sooner the better." "You're right," agreed Mum. "It doesn't do to neglect a roof." "What color would you like, dear?" asked Dad. "Red, and the brighter the better," she replied. A few days later, Diane and I woke to hear Dad hard at work on the roof. We bolted our breakfast, shot outside, and clambered up onto the huge boulder behind our house to get a little closer to the action. "Hey, Dad," we called up to him, "can we help?" "Well, let me see," he answered. "Maybe you could just hold a steady course right where you are and keep me company." "I could climb up the ladder and hand you things," Diane offered. "I'd be happier if you just stayed put," said Dad hastily. While Dad worked, Diane and I chattered away. Dad nodded his head from time to time or puffed out an absent-minded, "You don't say," while hammering down row after row of new red shingles. Eventually, our conversation petered out, and we sat in silence for a few minutes. Across the field next to our place, I noticed our neighbors pottering about in the maze that passed for their garden. "Look, Diane," I said, "there's Flossie and Jack. Let's pretend we're announcers on the radio, and we'll report what they're doing." "Good idea. That could be fun," Diane said, and immediately went into action. "This is radio station RSVP 200 on your dial, bringing you an up-to-date report on a late-breaking news story." Her voice rose with excitement. "Jack's checking his raspberry canes. Stay tuned, folks. Anything could happen." I broke in. "My goodness, you may find this hard to believe, listeners at home, but Flossie is actually pulling some rhubarb." Flossie and Jack were famous for their devotion to each other and their neglect of almost everything else. If the day was hot, Flossie said to her husband, "Jack, dear, I don't think you should work in the fields today. You might take heat stroke, and there, then, where would we be?" If the day was wet, she said, "Jack, my love, I don't think you should go out today. You might take a chill, and then where would we be?" Jack appreciated his wife's advice and was equally concerned for her welfare. When their kitchen garden was choked with weeds, he said, "Flossie, my dear, don't lift that hoe. You might do yourself a mischief. And then where would we be?" True to form, Jack and Flossie stopped their activities and stood as still as statues. Diane hesitated and then cleverly improvised, "Things are at a standstill, so we'll bring you a message from our sponsor. Don't touch that dial, we'll be right back." I sang one chorus of a popular soap jingle, does everything. And Diane finished off with, "You'll wonder where the yellow went when you brush your teeth with Pepsodent." Flossie and Jack drifted across their yard. "Welcome back, audience at home," Diane said warmly. "We're happy to tell you that our neighbors are back in action. They appear to be heading for their bench. They're almost there. They've made it, ladies and gentlemen. They're sitting down even as I speak." Jack's fanning his face with his hat. The bench was all that Flossie and Jack had in the way of garden furniture, and it was actually just a rough board resting on a couple of tree stumps. "Hang on," Diane continued. "There's a new development. Blackie's coming out of his doghouse. Don't touch that dial, folks. Dogs can be unpredictable. He's ambling over to join Flossie and Jack. He's there." Flossie's patting him, and Jack's scratching his ears. "Oh," she added hastily, "the dog's, I mean, not his own. I think Blackie's going to lie down." "He is. He's turning around. Stay with us, listeners. 1, 2... 3 turns," she counted, "and he's down. He's going to have a snooze." By this time, Dad was hopelessly distracted, so he edged closer to watch Jack and Flossie for himself. his gaze roamed over their wild garden before coming to rest on the roof of their house. "Holy smoke," he gasped. "Their roof is in worse shape than ours. It must leak like a sieve." That night, we heard Dad telling Mom about Jack's gap-toothed roof. "We're going to have shingles left over," said Dad. "What do you say I offer them to Flossie and Jack?" "That's a good idea," she said. "They'll probably be thrilled." Diane and I tagged along a week later when Jack delivered a wheelbarrow full of shingles. Flossie and Jack were on their bench enjoying the sunshine. Blackie was dozing peacefully at their feet. And although he didn't raise his head, he welcomed us with a few thumps of his tail. "Well now," drawled Jack with a wink, "sit down and take a load off your mind." The bench sagged alarmingly when Diane and I sat down, so Dad stayed standing. "Maybe you've noticed me shingling my roof," he began. Jack nodded. "Yep, I seen you hauling them heavy bundles up there. Me and Flossie was a mite worried. You could have had a rapture, and where would you be?" Flossie looked concerned. "All them hours in the hot sun, however did you manage?" Diane and I were pleased when Dad said that we'd kept him entertained. He continued, "I couldn't help notice that you're missing a few shingles." Flossie and Jack looked up at their roof in astonishment. "You don't say. You know, you're probably right. It does get a mite damp inside when it rains," Jack said. "Well then, could you use these shingles?" asked Dad. "I bought more than I needed, and it'd be a shame for them to go to waste." Flossie smiled sweetly. "That's real neighborly of you, thank you." Dad hoisted a bundle onto his shoulder and asked, "Where should we put them, Jack?" The question seemed to bewilder Jack. "Geez, I don't know," he said, rubbing his bristly chin. Flossie looked around and said, "We should put them where they'll be handy. Right there under the apple tree will do." Dad unloaded the wheelbarrow and we headed home. Weeks drifted by and the shingles languished where Dad had left them. He fumed about idle hands, sloth, and ingratitude. Mum tried to soothe his rising temper. Now, you know Jack takes a while to get around to things. He'll probably do a wonderful job once he puts his mind to it." Dad just snorted. Things boiled over one morning in late August, just as Diane and I came down to breakfast. Dad was sitting at the table with a cup of coffee, idly looking out the window towards Flossie and Jack's place. Suddenly, he leapt up with such force that his chair crashed backwards onto the floor. His eyes bugged out and his mouth sagged open. "Glory be to Peter," he roared, pointing across the field at Jack and Flossie's place. "Can you believe it? If that doesn't beat all, look, look." We looked and burst out laughing. No wonder Dad was so mad. Jack hadn't touched his own roof, but Blackie's doghouse was completely covered with perfectly straight rows of bright red shingles.
That's great. This is Louise Sproul, and I'm talking to author Sheila Hebert about her new book, Stonefield Stories. And you're so good at changing the voice back to, it's almost like your child's voice, which is narrating.
Is that right?
Yeah, I hear that. You know, you say, "We knew why Dad was so mad." You know, but that just, that's just great. Yeah. Anyway, that's just a taste of what's in your book, because every story, as you say, there are lessons, but nobody's hammered over the head with them. You know, you just learn it's just life.
Yes.
It's just life.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know that this is your first book, and you're getting ready to do a book launch, and you've ordered some books, and you're excited. You chose a nice artwork for your cover. You've really enjoyed the process,
yes.
I hope.
Oh, yes.
Good.
It's been wonderful. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your first official book event that you've got coming up.
Yes. We planned a book launch for the 27th of February. Mary Ellen Legault Mueller, who has illustrated all the stories, will be in attendance. And Louise, you will be there too to explain your role in it. And my son-in-law, Gordon, who is a photographer, will also be there. He worked on the photographs that we've included. they were in very bad condition. They were old black and white photographs. And he has managed to restore them. And I think they add a very nice dimension.
They are lovely to the book. The cattle wrestlers, especially.
Yes.
That's another good story.
Yes, yeah. I'm hoping a lot of people will come, and I hope that they'll enjoy seeing the book, and I hope they'll enjoy reading it. I'm very pleased so far with a couple of stories that I've shared with people have been very well received. So I think it will have appeal.
That's good. And Have you got some plans to do a launch in the area, maybe something in the Cushing or Carrier area?
I would really love to do that too. So I have to think about that and make some contacts. But I would really love to come back to as close to Stonefield as I can get.
Yes.
Because I know there are people that they'd be able to share so many memories with me too of their own. That would be, I'm sure I would find it fascinating.
Right. And so if people want to get in touch with you, they could send you an email, I guess, at this point.
That's right, yeah.
So your email address is?
It's Hebert, H-E-B-E-R-T, dot Sheila, S-H-E-I-L-A, at gmail.com.
Okay. And for other listeners in the area, in the Van Cliquil area, we have Sheila's book on sale here at the Review. It's $20 per copy, and we have a few to get started, and we'll get some more when those are gone. And you can always contact us here at the Review to find out more, and we'll be sharing a few pictures and things on Facebook. And I just want to thank you so much for coming in today, Sheila. It's been a real pleasure to just talk about your book and how it came into being. It's been really exciting.
Thank you very much, Louise. I appreciate all that you've done to help get this book to print.
Oh.
It's been a wonderful adventure and quite a steep learning curve for me at times, but I've enjoyed every step of the way. I thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. We've been talking to Sheila Hebert. She has just launched her new book called Stonefield Stories, a new book about old times in Stonefield.